For those of you who don't know me, I'm Steve Traylor. I'm the executive director of Nutella, and I was very happy to be asked to moderate today's session on how local governments can use broadband to save money and or to provide better services to the residents, maybe for a cheaper cost, and improve those type of services. Before I introduce our speakers, I just want to touch on one thing. I was always interested in broadband and how broadband can be used by local governments to save money. And one area that I have some knowledge about from my prior experience at the National Association of Counties is how counties can use broadband to decrease the cost of running elections. For example, the county of Maricopa, Arizona, saves about $145,000 every year in having online registration versus having to go through those individual slips of paper that you fill out to register to vote. During presidential election years, that savings increases by about four times. A recent report just came out by the Pew folks regarding how much it costs cities and counties to send out sample ballots. And they estimate that anywhere between 11 to 49% of the cost of running an election is mailing out those sample ballots. The county of Los Angeles spent about $9 million this past year on one election sending out those sample ballots. And here we are in San Francisco. According to this report, if only 15% of registered voters in San Francisco receive their ballots online versus being mailed, San Francisco would save about $200,000 for every election. So when Ken mentioned earlier this morning that elected officials are starting to get it, they get it when they find out they can save money. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists today. We do have a couple PowerPoints for you all. Our first speaker will be Denise Brady. Denise, most of you all know, she's a lifetime member of NATOA and a former NATOA president. Then we have Nancy Alfaro, who's the head of San Francisco's 311 Customer Service Center. And then we're going to have Joaquin Alvarado, who a lot of you also know, and he's going to be speaking third and going to just wrap this up for us. So again, their bios are available online. You can find out more about them. And right now, I'll hand it over to Denise.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's so nice to be back at NATOA. After 5 or 6 years after leaving the city, I've retired, for those of you that don't know it. And today I'm going to talk about San Francisco's broadband network and some of the brief history of it and some of the applications that the city's been able to deploy and use because they have this great network capacity. Unfortunately, my PowerPoint presentation won't open. So I was able to go online just now and pull up an older version that I emailed to someone at the city and said, check this out and let me know where it's wrong. So it's going to have some XXXs where things were filled in, and as long as you realize that my memory isn't what it used to be, I will plug those numbers in as I go through the presentation. Also, there are some slides that were just placeholders and so forth. So bear with me, and we'll do the best we can. And I'll make sure that Steve has the final PowerPoint presentation, which you can view later electronically. So San Francisco has been in the business of managing telecommunications networks for over 100 years. Its original fire pool box, and police telephone system started out as a telegraph in 1875. And around 1900, the Department of Electricity was created with the city, and the city actually took over managing and operating that network. And you'll still see them as you visit San Francisco during your stay here. You'll see the red fire alarm pool boxes and the blue police call boxes. And in emergencies, such as the 1989 earthquake, it's the only telecommunication system that operated in San Francisco reliably. And that, at that time, was a copper network. Today, it's all on the city's fiber network. And around about 50 years ago, we deployed the citywide radio system, which, of course, has had many evolutions since then, and today is somewhat state-of-the-art. And the Department of Telecommunications, which is where the electrical department resides today, has managed that, still manages that today, and operates it. And then in 2001, we deployed our first fiber network. So the fiber network came about because of a couple of opportunities through bond projects. The first one was for E911 in 2001. And the city needed to very, very rapidly connect six of its critical public safety facilities with big and reliable, robust broadband connections. And it just turned out that the incumbent local exchange carrier was going to need quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money to make that happen. I think at the time, $750,000 to connect those six buildings. And we realized that we could do it faster and for not that much more cost. And so we proceeded to use the bond funds to build a 14-mile network. And that network connected CECC is the city's emergency command center, City Hall. DITIS is the right down near where we are now. DITIS was where the city's mainframe data center was. Fire headquarters, Hall of Justice, and then CECC was connected to Twin Peaks by a microwave hop, and we made a fiber connection between those two, which became the primary with the microwave as a backup. And this is just to let you know that 14 miles of fiber does, even if it's an existing conduit, doesn't sound like a lot of work, but it went in and out of 350 manholes. So it gives you an idea when I talk miles what the amount of labor that goes into that. And this is the second project, which was in 2004. And that was a project to connect 11 campuses in the City Hall, the City College, Community College District of San Francisco. They had 11 campuses, and they were seeking a dedicated fiber network, which they could not pull off with their bond funds, but which the Department of Telecommunications was able to do. And that extended our network, and actually that's a number that changed. It's, I think, 30 miles, because we also then took it out to State College and connected that network to State College. So when we did that, we dedicated a certain number of strands to the City College project, but overbuilt it by, 200 strands or whatever the number might be, to serve the city's future needs. Again, city crews. I just like to throw a picture in now and then. Okay, so other projects. I'm going to kind of vary from these and talk from my printed copy of my original one, if I can find where I would be. Okay, well, there's a much larger list than this, but the mayor's office has given funding to complete these rings. You know, the network has, the primary foundation for the network was the public safety E911, which was a ring, a very robust and reliable ring. And rings have been built off of that, but so have just single extensions off of the network, some distance to meet a client department. And so now the funding's been received to go and close some gaps in the network, and in the process to route by other client departments. The Muni transportation, the bus system, that added another 10 miles recently, doing work for them in their conduits. We did another 9 miles for the San Francisco Public Utility Commission's water pollution control, connecting three outlying substations, sub-sewer stations, or sewer substations, I should say. And then we're currently doing a project for the port, which is a Homeland Security grant of some sort, that is providing cameras, linking cameras along the Embarcadero, along the waterfront for security issues. That's a pretty comprehensive system that the network will be supporting. The city has 1,300 facilities. Now, that isn't all buildings. That would be these substations. That would be, General Hospital might have 50 buildings in it, and that would count as 50, for example. So we have 1,300 facilities. Of those today, we have 110. That number did change, served by the fiber optic network. We lease 600 T1s and 11 DS3 circuits at a cost of $2.5 million a year, along with all of the normal low-capacity circuits. So the city's spending $2.5 million a year on what's left. And I don't know that the research has been done to determine what it's not paying because of the 110 connections, and I'd be curious to know that number. The city just recently approved year one of a multi-year budget to start migrating critical infrastructure onto the network. So the projects that are going forward are less likely to extend in significant ways the footprint of the network, but it's populating with services the existing network. It might be too small for you to really see, and it is. So we'll pass on that one. Okay. Too bad. This was a really good list. So the current applications, obviously, are the 911, the data, all the data invoice, fire dispatching, the mayor's emergency telephone system, fire call boxes, and police system are all on the fiber. Shot spotters. Does anybody here know what a shot spotter is? A shot spotter is a system out in certain neighborhoods that will identify gunshots and alert the police where gunshots are occurring and as they occur. We have 300 surveillance cameras being supported on the network. The health department, we just did a big network extension for the health department, which connects three of their 12 facilities. We anticipate connecting all of their facilities in the few coming years. With three rings, and we've done a design. You know, I say we out of habit. I'm not there anymore, but I still consider this my baby. Okay, and we have our leasing service to UCSF and Scenic. Is anybody here familiar with Scenic? I'll let Joaquin, I'm sure he'll be talking some about Scenic, and he'll tell you what that it is. But it's, in a nutshell, it's a California initiative or program that connects all of the educational institutions in California. Telemedicine. The San Francisco Health Department is using telemedicine now. And one thing that I think is really interesting in the applications is, and this is a partnership with criminal justice, to move a prisoner to go to the doctor from, we have a jail in San Bruno, which is down past the airport, and we have jail facilities here in San Francisco. And to bring a prisoner to the doctor, it's an all-day event, and it requires two uniformed guards or sheriffs to accompany the prisoner, and they have to do a big preparation for he or she to leave the facility. And then when they come back, they have to do that reverse process. And it's very costly. And so they're now using telemedicine, or just beginning to use telemedicine, to be able to have a doctor visit remotely. And if required, then they will bring the patient in, but they're able to treat a certain number of patients remotely. And that's a really cool application, I think, that could be replicated. Our traffic department has about 40 miles of its own fiber. And in recent years, it's hard sometimes when you don't have legislation that requires everybody to play together. People tend to want to go out on their own and ensure that they get the best possible product they can for themselves. And that did happen with the traffic department, who got a lot of grants to build fiber networks. But they are partnering quite nicely now. And the Department of Telecommunications is now maintaining all of their networks, fiber cuts and those kinds of things, and doing some slicing for them. And when they are building out their network, DT is able to get in there, and if they wanted a 24 count of fiber, they'll add a 100 and something to it for the city, and the city will pay the difference. So it's really working out nicely. We did lose probably 30 of those 40-mile opportunities, but, it happens. And traffic's doing some amazing things. Their goal is to connect all of their traffic signals in the city and all traffic devices and cameras to their network operating center. And they've got quite a bit of that done. And we'll continue in that vein. Okay, this is a duplicate, I think. Oh, no, the bottom one is a cool one. Internet access, 37 public housing complexes have been added to the fiber network. And they're serving thousands of, more than 2,000, thousands of housing units. And so they're reaching the internet over the fiber and then wireless distribution throughout each complex. And that is our Tuesday at noon air raid. It started out in 1950 as an air raid system, and now it gives announcements. It was upgraded after 9/11, and I always say, you know, it's going to say something like, kiss your ass goodbye. But that's the message I'm fearful of hearing. But until then, I think it says something like, this is a test. Okay. Now, here is, this is a good resource, I think, for understanding a little bit about the future of public safety applications and disaster response. And there's an organization called Project MESA. And it's an international partnership to create standards for mobile telecommunications. And I think this is a great site to go visit. I think it's www.projectmesa.org. And I'll go through this list a little bit about what they envision. So criminal justice providers, we talked a little bit about the ability to treat prisoners in incarcerated where they live, and you can also do the same with depositions and attorney interviews and other things that would require might require a prisoner to be transported. And also, then of course, there is all of the police real time fingerprints, real time iris scans, real time criminal histories and so forth. And some, like iris scan, is still in development, but it's something they anticipate having in the future. And of course, these kinds of real-time technologies are going to just eat up bandwidth for all the backhaul and everything else. So it's something good to know about. And then emergency management or disaster response, some of it I think you can imagine. One of the things they talk a lot about are micro and macro, the development of micro and macro robotics to do a lot of what humans would have to do now. So, for example, testing air, testing hazardous materials, going into spaces looking for survivors that we are too unsafe for people to go into. Health services, we talked about telemedicine really is the primary one. Mobile, it would be being able to have two-way video where a doctor can see a patient in treatment on at the site of an accident or a disaster and on the way back in an ambulance and be able to advise on treatment. Also, remote ability to analyze a patient's blood or other medical testing. Fire services, there's some really cool things on the way in fire services in terms of being able to monitor a firefighter's stats, whether or not they're mobile or not, whether or not their heart rate is dangerously high, and so forth. To be able to transmit building plans where hazardous materials might be on a particular site, where exits are, general floor plan of the building. Coast Guard services, real-time surveillance for harbors and ports, airport security services. And that, I think, was really about two-way communication within airports to police and the tower and so forth. Hazardous materials I touched on. Correctional institutions we've discussed. Large-scale special event planning, they had some unique applications for that. We've already talked and we'll talk throughout the week about general government administration. Being able to monitor dams, rivers, bridges real-time. And transportation systems we talked about a little bit, too, with cameras and traffic signals and next bus services and so forth. And then last, I think I'm just going to go right into the last one now. Okay, and so San Francisco, its network has a capacity of 10 billion bits per second or more between city facilities, so it should be able to handle all the kinds of things we're going to be talking about this week. And the availability of this network, I think, really is a petri dish for innovation. City managers looking for solutions are not constrained by the cost of or the inability to get a network. Usually it's not something in the manager who's a service provider's purview to be able to make those kinds of commitments. And the fact that it's here and so robust and so inexpensive, relatively speaking, to connect to, it really is spurring on innovation and helping city managers consider broadband-intensive business solutions. So we're very well positioned, I think, in San Francisco to be early adopters of these kinds of technologies as they come out and to be attractive for grants and partnerships with industry because we have this great resource. So that's it. And if you have questions, maybe we'll have time at the end. Otherwise, you can come up and see me later. Thank you. Let's see. Let's get to desktop. I wonder if you put it right at the end. Let me see. Oh, very good. Okay. And then we need to go here. Okay.
Nancy, how far? I'll go around.
All right. Good afternoon. So I'm Nancy Alfaro. I'm the director of the 311 Customer Service Center for the City and County of San Francisco. So for those of you who live in San Francisco, I hope you do use our service, and if not after today, I'm sure you will. And for those that are from other cities, I'm sure you're going to want to have this system because we do feel that we are the hub for access information and service for our visitors, residents, tourists, anyone who comes to San Francisco. Oh, how do I go to the next one here?
Top upper right corner, page down, way up in the right corner.
All right, but what am I supposed to press? All right. So we went live in March of 2007, and I don't think this was my first slide.
Yeah,
that's my first slide. All right. So first of all, why 311? We had our current lieutenant governor Gavin Newsom had visited Baltimore and Chicago and saw that there was a 311 center there. And when he came to San Francisco, he wanted to get a marriage license, and went through the phone book. And after going through 2,300 phone numbers in the phone book, couldn't find what agency dealt with marriage licenses. So he really wanted to have 311 to San Francisco. And at the time, he was a supervisor. So once he became mayor, he really had a vision that wanted to bring this together to San Francisco. So we wanted to have one easy-to-remember number that people could call. We wanted to simplify the city services. Very importantly, we wanted to have a live person that could answer the call 24/7, 365 days a year, as well as be very culturally sensitive. So we do have translation services available for over 175 languages, and that was really important for our mayor. Our goal is to answer 80% of our calls within 60 seconds, and we want to make sure that you do get a first call resolution. So nearly 97% of our calls get either their answer or we take their service at the time of their call. So we're not transferring to other places. We went live in March of 2007, and on this slide it says we nearly answered 12 million calls today, but actually as of 2 days ago, we have answered our 12 millionth call. When we had our consultants do research as to how many calls we were going to receive, they had predicted about 1.2 million calls a year. They were very wrong. So we didn't expect the call volume that we got, and part of the reason for that was that even though they were surveying the different city departments, a lot of the calls that were being unanswered weren't taken into account. So we realized that when people were getting the service and actually getting a live person answering their calls, the call volume just skyrocketed. So we did get a lot more calls than what we had originally anticipated. We are now answering about 220,000 calls per month, and we have 67 customer service reps that answer those calls. We have 6 supervisors and 13 support staff on board. We do serve as the physical backup for 911, and when the Department of Elections as well, and when the whole H1N1 situation came about, we also worked with the Department of Public Health to serve as a backup in case there is any communicable disease situation where we can actually get medical experts on board to use part of our call center. So it's really important for us when we're taking calls for city departments that we want to be able to simplify services. So when we work with the various city departments, we don't want to just duplicate whatever they were doing already. We want to be able to simplify service by having a very robust knowledge base within our system, and we want to make sure that the services are being routed to the appropriate agencies. In San Francisco, not every graffiti complaint, for example, goes to one department, so it's really important that we do get it to the right place so that it can be serviced efficiently. And we want to make sure that we try to make the services available through the various channels. So we did start with just phone, but then we wanted to make sure that we expanded that to self-service, online services, as well as social media, and now a lot of people having the smartphones using the mobile applications. So as you can see here, we started, again, with the bad prediction of our call volume. We were seeing a 7 to 9% month-to-month increase on our call volume. So there was no way, especially with the time of the budget crisis that we were having in San Francisco, for us to continue to get the staffing levels so that we could answer the phones within our 80% of calls being answered in 60 seconds. So it was really important for us to try to see what else we could do and try to provide the service through other means. So as you can see, by 2008, by December, by the fourth quarter, you'll start seeing a dip down. That's because we introduced our self-service portal. So we wanted to make sure that people had the option of submitting some of these requests online. And that really worked because we did start seeing that trend. And although a future slide, you'll see that about 18% of our services that we can offer are being done online, that doesn't take into account a lot of the informational calls that we could get answered over the self-service portal. So if somebody wants to get a marriage license or something like that, they can actually get the information through our online service and they wouldn't call, but we can't really measure that through our numbers. So when we're creating our services, we want to make sure that we do know what their service level is and where it's going to go so that it can be routed to the right place. So we do have a matrix, and we want to make sure that we understand what the work process is. And this is really important. For example, when we were handling resident complaints for those living like in single residency occupancy hotels, a lot of the problems that they wanted to report could be addressed by 5 different departments. We were dealing with building inspection issues, health issues, fire department issues, and we want to make sure that whatever we do, when the person calls 311, they don't need to worry about what department handles their issue, nor can we train staff to remember all that information. So it's important that when they're making a selection through our customer relationship management system, that the system automatically knows where it needs to go. And it's worked by the appropriate agency, and that's really important so that our staff trust that the system will do the work for them. But the other piece that's really important is to make sure that we can provide the customer with the expectation of when things can get done. So this was very new when we were working with departments because they didn't have reporting capabilities, a lot of them did not. We wanted to make sure that they set some type of expectation that we could communicate to the customer so that if a pothole would be fixed in 2 days, they would know that that's what they should expect to see. But if it's a graffiti issue that could take over 30 days to get done, if it's at a private residence, for example, at least the person knows not to call us back within a week, knowing that it could take up to 30 days. And I think that's a big piece also, that people want to know when they can expect something to be done. So we did work with the departments to make sure that they could commit to some type of service level agreement. So as we introduced the web and Twitter and our mobile applications, we did see, again, a huge dip from our call volume, and we're seeing an increase in the green shows here our self-service portal, so about 18% to 20% of our services are being done online, and we're still working to improve on these numbers by making things easier, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. And then we're having the Twitter and the Open 311 platform, which we're seeing a lot more being done, and we're actually working on an application that we hope to launch in a couple of months that will make submission through a smartphone even easier. So we do expect those numbers to be going up even further. So we're still working towards improving on these numbers to minimize some of the call volumes coming into our center. But it doesn't mean that we don't want the calls coming in. We want to make sure that we're just capturing and offering different channels, because some people prefer to go online or prefer to use their phone instead of reaching a live person. So we want to make sure that we have the handheld alternative. Right now, we do recognize that our self-service portal requires a lot of clicks to get into it, that some of the things that we're trying to improve, and not all of our forms are available online, so we're trying to make improvements in that area. With the Open 311 platform, what's nice is that it allowed developers to create apps for the city for free. So there are, if you go to our 311 website, you can see how to communicate with 311, and you can see about 5 different apps that you can use for your Android or iPhones to submit requests to the city. And we're going to be developing one as well with a vendor that will make things easier. But these are things that, you know, could cost the city a lot of money that we're saving by having developers do applications for us. So the social media is a big thing, so we really want to be able to stay with the time. So we were the first city that introduced the Twitter for managing cases. So someone can submit a request to us, and we will respond and provide the tracking number to the customer. Originally, our mayor wanted to have us handle text messaging. Well, that was going to cost about $500,000 for us to do something like that, and we weren't sure how much use there would be on that. And by introducing Twitter, it solved that issue, because people could now, you know, use the Twitter instead of text messaging, and it worked, and it was free and fast. So then we decided to go into Facebook because we also feel there's an audience there that people wanting to go through Facebook, and it does eliminate people having to re-enter information if they're already signed up to Facebook, so they can easily send and create discussions even through the Facebook on submitting requests to us. So other uses that we've done for social media is we do use Twitter to send out events that we have going on within the city, so that hopefully, again, all of this is based on trying to minimize call volumes to us. So if there's a big event going on, like there was recently an Outside Lands concert here in San Francisco, we'll send a notice out at that. Or if there's any emergency situation that we want to let people know about, we'll also do that for major events. And we are also part of the emergency operations system, so we will also send out communications that are submitted through that office. The other piece that's really important about 311 is making sure that departments are accountable for the work that they're being done. So we don't feel that we're successful if the receiving agencies aren't responding to customers' complaints or reports. So it's really important that they do get reports in terms of how they're doing within the requests that have been submitted through 311. So we do meet with them, and we provide reports to them so that they can make sure that they're getting their service requests taken care of within that time. So we do feel that these reports are important for the performance, and as managers, they're really appreciating the benefit that our 311 reports can provide them. We are also working on providing reports in a map view format, which a lot of the Board of Supervisors members are really liking, because they can see what is going on within their district. And if on a graffiti issue, for example, they can look at trends and then work with the police department to see where they might need to have more police dispatched in order to address hot sites for graffiti. And lastly, what we are working on is we're trying, again, to improve on our self-service portal. So we're trying to do a personalized website that we were going to be MySF311 so that people can actually create a login and password, and they can actually see the history of the request that they have submitted. They can track the request, and they don't have to be re-entering their information every time they're going to submit something. But they also can give a little bit of information about themselves so that we can then provide information about what's going on in their neighborhood, and their so we can personalize it a little bit. So in here, you know, they can then search by the tracking number, and they can see, for example, what they have submitted so that they can have a good view of how they can interact with the city. And that ends my presentation. So as Denise said, we can answer any questions at the end, or I'll be available to answer any questions for you. Thank you.
So first of all, thanks for having me again. I've got about 9 of these now, I think, thanks to the good partnership that I've enjoyed with all of you folks. And I know a lot of you, so it's good to see some familiar faces. I was going to talk tomorrow with Brewster, so I'm going to steal some of my remarks and insert them here, but I did want to just maybe tell an anecdote. I met Denise like 8 years ago. I was at San Francisco State. And somehow, I don't know if it was leaked, I don't know if it was left in a bathroom somewhere at City Hall, that map that she showed with the City College campuses and San Francisco State appeared. And we were actually in the process of trying to build an initiative around digital media on the campus. And we knew that high-speed connectivity was a critical path for digital media companies, of which San Francisco views itself as a sort of capital for. And so I went on this manhunt, which turned out to be a Denise Brady hunt, to figure out how we could get onto that map somehow. And so I had no idea what any of you guys did at the time. So I went into City Hall. I think we had a cup of coffee or something. And at the end of it, I was kind of astounded that this actually happens. I mean, it's amazing. And then to see 311 blossom, we spent many years working with Chris Vian and Denise and Brian Roberts and a whole bunch of people at DTIS here in San Francisco. And it's phenomenal to me how much work is going on that we really don't celebrate enough, and we don't connect the dots around oftentimes. You know, we're in weird times in this country right now. I'm in public broadcasting, so I'll describe how weird it is in a moment here. But there's a lot of good progress. You know, there's just a lot of good work going on, and this is 7 or 8 years old that these plans have been out there, probably 125 years old. Somebody was talking about Telegraph in a similar way. This is good stuff. We can do something with this. And I think a customer-centric, citizen-centric approach, as described by the 311 work, is really, really important. So I want to kind of just hone in on that a little bit. I want to talk about the social aspects of governments and how I think that there's a lot of overlap with the nonprofit media community at large, and specifically public broadcasting, which is pretty well represented in most communities in the country, small, medium, and large. You know, we're in the business, we have 2 or 3 core businesses as public broadcasters. One is journalism, so covering local issues. That is really bread and butter for a lot of us. And there's not a lot of that going on in some communities right now as the economics of journalism change. So even that loop of the citizen to their local representative democracy, you know, and services goes untended when there's no accountability reporting around what happens in communities. So we think that we have a lot to do around that. And we spend a lot of time working on it. We have a lot of people working on it. In most communities in the country, there's a public broadcasting station that has a few reporters at least, sometimes more. So that's one. The other is on education. And this is something that I know we did work on in the Bay Area here and in San Francisco. There is an enormous amount of innovation occurring right now in digital media, content, gaming, and education. And the folks who are producing the innovations need more and more partnership from local governments in order to actually get that in front of students. So in San Francisco at the housing projects, actually, I think one of the first things we did at the Valencia Gardens, new housing, public housing in the Mission District on the fiber network. We were able to deliver some gaming-based instruction around science in partnership with the California Academy of Sciences, which is also on fiber in Golden Gate Park, and had the kids interacting with scientists, had them out in the community using mobile to capture content and share that with instructors, did training on game design. None of that would have been possible without the infrastructure that Denise was describing. So I think that that is a scalable model in most communities in the country. And there are willing partners in your public broadcasting station in those communities. So happy to share more about that later. We've been sort of banging on this with NATOA for 6 or 7 years here. I think there's an inflection point for us. As we think about a customer-centric approach to all of this, really the engagement layer that is possible around services, broadband for most Americans is still fairly obtuse, right? I've spent a lot of time trying to talk to communities, talking to companies, talking to citizens about how to get activated around it. Probably some of the examples that Graham was citing and what he did in Indiana, those are some of the best out there. But we still have a long way to go. But I'll just describe one scenario that we're starting to worry about. Most broadband plans on your mobile phone are now, thanks to the companies, they include bandwidth caps, right? So you can have tiered pricing now and not even know it, or be very cognizant of it. Like for those first few who bought their iPads before the bandwidth caps, solid gold. Never get off those plans. Now you go to buy it, and you're paying a tier on both Verizon and AT&T, right? So when we think about our mandate, we think about free access to high-quality non-commercial media, right, for kids, for communities. We can't imagine taxing a parent, a low-income parent, who wants their kid to interact with PBS content on their iPhone, right, when that's the only available broadband device they have in a home. So what do we do to solve that? We're working on that in our own way. We actually have to partner with local governments to solve that. What happens in a public safety situation where you want to encourage citizens to use their mobile broadband devices to share critical content, right, during times of crisis, right? We don't actually have a trigger to prevent a tax being levied against those folks for a public interest activity in the form of these bandwidth caps. And this happens, right? It happens in this country. You know, one of our great sort of heroes in public media is what Lafayette, Louisiana has done around their own bandwidth, and I know they've been honored by NATOA in the past. But when you think about Hurricane Katrina and the opportunity to do important first responder intel work at the community level in those devices, how do we actually address the fact that if these bandwidth caps are the only way by which Americans who depend on mobile for bandwidth, that they can actually share with their local government, public safety, folks who can do something about it. So I actually think we have to partner on conceiving of different models or making available networks to communities that can diversify the way that we actually interact with broadband. And that's something that we're starting to talk to families about, we're starting to talk to schools about, and libraries. We just launched a project actually in King County with the libraries up there called Librarius. We have a platform that's like a CRM platform for journalism. We try to engage citizens in informing our reporting through their own expertise. We get away from the pundits. Let's have citizens talk about what they actually know and how it impacts their communities. Well, we partnered with the American Library Association and the Public Library Association to build an app for libraries to run on their homepage or on mobile that will encourage people to start a dialogue around how they're using those libraries. And for us, it was the opportunity to actually engage Americans who need to go to the library for their bandwidth. But also for the libraries, it started to create this enormous wealth of narrative about just how important libraries were to them. And folks who used to have access at home, who because of the recession had had to trade off that in exchange for keeping other things turned on, we now have literally hundreds of powerful stories, and I think we're up to about 750 libraries deploying this application on their home sites and on their mobile. So I would love to have a conversation with anybody who's interested on how we're actually able to build something together that can deploy the resources that we have in every community in the country. And the work that you're doing at the local government level Before GigU was given to the world by the brilliant people working on it, and we're big fans of that, we had a framework that NATOA was a partner on that was similar, which we called National Public Light Path. But it was seeking to bring local government together with public broadcasting and universities to start building tools that could really make a difference. And quite organically, it's happening, right? We didn't do it. The 311 open platform, these things are already happening. I'm on the board at TechSoup Global. I don't know if you guys know about TechSoup, but it serves a lot of community nonprofits. We have enormous and vast networks. If we can just connect those dots a little bit, I think that we can drive innovation, increase services, and lower costs pretty consistently. We've seen that model. But I don't think we can do it in a meaningful enough way unless the story is told and the constituent here, the citizen, can actually interact with that. And I think if I can just use, how much time do I have? Okay, I've got a couple of jokes, if you guys don't mind. I just want to talk about them. Let me go through these. First of all, there's an old Woody Allen joke, which is based on an old, I think, Marx Brothers joke about, and I feel this way about both how our job is perceived sometimes, but certainly the hits that local government takes, right? Because the polarizing debate that happens in D.C. almost is unintelligible when you get down to the city level, right? So what my kids are confronting in Oakland Public Schools is almost like we're on a different planet from the conversation that's happening in D.C., or even Sacramento sometimes, for that matter. So here goes the joke. You know, there's the old line about the person who goes to the restaurant and says, oh, the food is horrible there, and the portions are really small. So we like to bang on government, but the solutions that we depend on them for are enormous, right? It's actually the place where we go when we actually need things in our community. There needs to be a way to narrate that differently. And I grew up in this, I'm a child of the 70s. My parents were, you know, sort of children of the 50s who went through the 60s. We don't have enough disaster films right now. Like, there needs to be some urgency injected into this because what's at stake is quite considerable. You know, if you remember the Poseidon Adventure or the Towering Inferno, you're never sure who you're going to end up with in the disaster film, who's stuck on the floor together, who's trapped in the only part of the ship with air. We're stuck with each other in our communities, and we're looking around saying, well, what the hell are we going to do now? We've got to think about different combinations. We've got to change the dynamic a little bit consistently. Graham and I got to spend some time together at the Aspen Institute this summer, and we came up with a concept which I would love to recruit 5 to 10 to everybody in the room, where we call it Go Franklin. Well, you know, the problems today are not harder than the problems confronted when the country was being put together, right? In fact, in some ways, we have a lot more tools than they did. But Ben Franklin figured out that, well, for every major problem, he could create a solution that never existed before. He kind of had a knack for that, the post office. So what things are we waiting to create, you know, that we really need each other to do? And could we find a handful of communities that wanted to invest in solutions together where we could bring public broadcasting, local governments can bring their best thinking, their best solutions, we can recruit community members into the fold, and we can have companies go with us on these things. In the end, all of those things have to be able to actually balance each other, not compete in some meaningful way. So we, Graham and I and a handful of us, committed to trying to do this in the next 12 months, is to really put everything we have, and I know there's different initiatives out there, we don't need new initiatives, but for what we're interested in, we really do want to engage communities differently. And I think that we have some neat ideas for that. We've done some cool things. The librarians thing is one of them. We have the staff that's working on this stuff. We got boots on the ground, so to speak. So if there's a way that we can kind of use NATOA as a platform, which is what I've always felt you guys represent, you're a platform that actually has, you know, you're where the rubber hits the road. I would love to really just continue this great partnership we have had. I think there's another generation to this partnership, which could be really interesting in the coming 12 months. And I know Blair's speaking tomorrow. You got Craig Newmark. You got Brewster. You got some really interesting folks here, and it's just great to be a part of that. And look forward to talking with everybody.
Well, I know we almost caught up with time here, but I do want to provide just a couple minutes for a couple questions if we've got those before we have lunch. So if anyone has a question, please stand up and yell it out, and you've got some great panelists here to answer them for you. So anybody have a question? Joanne.
I'm going to ask Joaquin to be concrete. So in the room, we have hundreds and hundreds of miles of government over fiber represented in rural, urban, and suburban areas. So tell us a story about what one of these partnerships you're talking about would look like in concrete terms.
So part of my job at American Public Media is to... Sure. Joanne asked for a concrete story about what this might look like if the hundreds of miles of local government community fiber were brought to bear. What could we bring to the table that would make it interesting? Good? Here's an idea. I think that as public media producers, American Public Media runs public radio stations. We do national shows like Marketplace and Prairie Home Companion. And we also build digital applications to support journalism and audience engagement. I believe that it's our job, in partnership with our public media brothers and sisters and partners, to develop a gigabit content channel for local communities. I think that we've got to bring the best that we do in terms of public radio and public television to the mix, but we have to build something that is interactive, that leverages gig capacity, and that does more than television or radio has ever been able to do up to this point and is more than a website. So how many folks in the room have Netflix? Right? Netflix, without telling anybody, except until recently, they kind of have to talk about it more, they've changed your relationship to television and movies. Right? They've brought the best of the web and social and lean back together. Right? So, you know, most of the time, most of my friends in the consumer space, when they watch television series, they do it on Netflix. And they do it back to back to back to back. And then they go series by series. There's a whole new behavior out there for how people want to consume content. The traditional broadcast, not going away. But we actually need communities that have this kind of capacity to experiment in developing the next great service for public broadcasting, which I think is going to be mobile and gigabit. So if you've got the fiber, we've got content. We have national partners and local partners who want to develop this service together. We just need communities to do it in. So when we think about Gig U, we think about communities that we can build this new service for. When we think about education, we think about the ability to weave gaming into public media content in new and innovative ways. When we think about local engagement, we think about strengthening democracies. Even if you're not an audience member, we have a responsibility to those communities. We think about our platforms being a resource in strengthening the community dialogues. So the answer is, if you've got the fiber, we've got content and apps that need that fiber.
Good question.
Yes.
My question is for Nancy. Is 311, is that a San Francisco department, or is it a nonprofit, or?
It is a city department.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I might just add to that. 311 is a number that's been set aside for government to do this. 211 is a number that's been set aside for nonprofit services, and so 311 is available, and San Francisco has the 311 department, which Nancy runs.
One thing I wondered about on the 311 project is, how did you put together the information necessary to make it work? You have all these people answering the phones. They have to know where to send people, what departments handle, or at least they have to have the application that does that. How did you get all that information in one place?
I was hired, I've been with the city for 20 years, but I came to 311 in 2006, and my responsibility was exactly to build a knowledge base for the city. And that was working. What we did is we did create a 311 liaison for every department within the city that we worked with to build the knowledge base. So by the time that we opened, we would have answers to the questions to the various departments. We still work with them, so a lot of times if we don't have an answer within our system and we have a process in place that it goes to our content team so that they work with the liaison to get the answer and load it into the knowledge base, so the knowledge base gets smarter and smarter as we've used it. And as departments have new programs in place, that liaison is responsible for letting our group know that this is what they have, and we make sure that we create a solution for that as well. So we have over 6,000 solutions available on the system to answer questions. And that's why when a department approaches us saying, for example, the tax collector recently had a kindergarten to college program that they were putting together, and they didn't have a call center in place. They came to us wanting us to help them. And it's really important when we accept to take on those responsibilities that we're not going to be a switchboard, so we don't want to just be transferring back the calls to the tax collector. We want to make sure that we do have information available so that our reps can answer the questions that may come into place.
And everything's open source?
No. Our knowledge, we're working on having our knowledge base exposed externally. That's part of our next project. But right now, we don't have it externally exposed. Some of it we do that we've put on our website, like we've created veterans portals, that we've created a lot of information on school districts, but we do hope to have all of our knowledge base available externally, because right now, if somebody goes online and searches a question on just our SFGov website, a lot of times you get like minutes or things like that, so it's not that useful, so we're trying to change that and expose what we have, what our reps see out to the public, so we're working on that.
Aloha, Sean McLaughlin, Access Humboldt. I just wanted to make a quick reference for those in rural areas. I know 211 is more familiar, and in California, less than half the counties actually have 211 service activated. PUC just implemented a rule that will make 211 available in emergency applications and designated 211 California as a statewide entity, just as an example of sort of that dynamic. But I wanted to quickly ask Joaquin just to help us think through some of the closer to the bone sort of dynamic. There's a history between PBS and community access, obviously, and community radio, where the national organizations really made it very difficult for low power FM, and there's sort of a damaged history there of relationships. I think your presence and the vision that you're projecting for public broadcasting from a community point of view, I made this joke at the Free Press thing. It's like Columbus must have felt when he discovered localism. You know, guess what? There are people doing local media for a long time, and I know you know this, but I just think it's an important part of the conversation. In our community, for example, PBS just multicast now. They have four channels. Well, all of a sudden, they needed our content, and so our PBS station in Eureka is now re-airing our Board of Supervisors coverage on one of their extra channels, which I think is a really good example of the kinds of opportunities at that really local content sharing level. And the same happens the other way. They'll do a candidate forum, and they only have airtime once to air it, and we'll repeat the heck out of it on our channels later. So I think maybe at that kind of content, as opposed to you're the content and we're the infrastructure, you know, I know it's not that simple. I just want to encourage you to sure. talk about the dynamics between government access, community access, education access, and broadcasting.
Yeah, it's a long and at times rocky relationship. But I think what's different is the mobile infrastructure that's going to be so important for how Americans connect is a totally different ballgame with a lot of questions, which I think Blair may hit on. But there's a lot of questions about how non-commercial content continues to survive and thrive in those spaces. Second, let's just talk about the fiber, right? The broadcast tower model is not what we're talking about. We're talking about fiber that is not just capacity, but has the ability to allow for applications. And especially if we have communities where there are institutions like schools or libraries on a fiber network, or homes or public housing, there's a lot that we could be doing, which is not possible under the broadcast tower infrastructure that we have grown up on. So new set of rules, new day. And I think also serving local communities is a different proposition, right? When I look at the graffiti map or the data that they have at 311 right now, if you are a reporter in San Francisco where you have to do more with less, or there have been a lot of layoffs at the Chronicle as an example, this is the kind of data that can drive reporting, actually. How is a community doing? Here's access to all of these data tools coming in directly from the community. That could cut in half, three quarters, change the nature of the reporting that's happening on those communities and about those communities. So I think that if we think about it as a different kind of application layer, as a different set of infrastructure components, we don't have to recreate the model that we grew up in over the last 40 years. And it, especially around the function of PEG specifically, we need to build a different constituency or a new generation that understands the value of PEG. And I think by doing things which are locally focused and have innovation at their core, there's a lot of opportunity there. There's a lot of opportunity there.
Well, thank you. I ask you all to give the panelists a round of applause for participating today. And I got the evil eye twice, so it is time for lunch, folks.